All right, everyone, I'm going to get started. So my name is Rich Perzer, and my day job is as an engineering professor at the university, or at Hofstra University. But I also obviously love baseball. I actually do get the opportunity to teach baseball. I taught a baseball analytics class last semester, and a couple semesters ago, I did teach a history of the Negro Leagues class. My day job is to teach engineering, but I get to do a lot of different things, thankfully. What I'm going to talk to you about today is the 1935 Negro National League Championship Series between the New York Cubans and the Pittsburgh Crawfords. My family has deep roots here in Pittsburgh, including my grandparents who grew up here, and my grandfather, my dad's father, told me of going to see Homestead Grays games back in his youth, and that's one of the things that sparked the interest that I have in studying the Negro Leagues. And as you'll learn, this was an incredible series played between two fantastic teams. And before I get started, I'd like to thank Ted Knorr, Todd Peterson, and Gary Ashwell for their assistance in my putting together the information for this presentation. So first, in discussing the 1935 Negro League season, this was the second installment of the Negro National League, and this was the third year of that, and it was going relatively strong despite the economy of the time in the United States. It was also the first year that the Cubans were in the Negro National League, and the Crawfords had been a part of the Negro National League. They were owned by two prominent Negro League aficionados, Gus Greenlee and Alex Pompez. There were eight teams in the league. The league was made up of the Crawfords, Cubans, Columbus Elite Giants, Philadelphia Stars, Homestead Grays, Brooklyn Eagles, Coles American Giants, which was a team out of Chicago, and the Newark Dodgers. When you look at the 35 Crawfords, they are sometimes mentioned as one of the greatest teams of all time, sometimes mentioned in the same breath as the 27 Yankees, and they were certainly a formidable squad. When you look at this team with a lineup with a leadoff hitter of Cool Papa Bell and Josh Gibson hitting cleanup, you know you're dealing with a really good team. Just to put in context this team and their age at the time, Josh Gibson was 23 years old in 35, Sam Bank had 24, Leroy Matlock, the ace of the Crawford staff, was 24 years old as well. I'm sorry, 28 years old. Judy Johnson, future Hall of Famer, was 35, and Oscar Charleston, the manager and player on the team, was 38. Clearly a very strong lineup, maybe a little top-heavy on the pitching side, but incredible. The Cubans as well were an excellent team. Their best player and best-known player is Martin DeHigo, who was 30 years old at the time. He played third base, he played center field, he pitched all in the series, and he managed the team. Alejandro Ohms was 39 years old. He was the senior member of the team. Rap Dixon, 32 years old, down to schoolboy Johnny Taylor, who was 19 years old. They probably had better pitching than the Crawfords, and a very interesting, if maybe underrated, offensive lineup. Now, the regular season was made up of two halves, and the winner of the first half was scheduled to play the winner of the second half in the championship series. The Crawfords got out to a great start that series, and started out 24-6, and so they won the first half. When we think of the Crawfords again, we think of an incredible team, but you'll notice one name was missing two slides ago, and that was Satchel Paige, who's often thought of as a prominent member of the Crawfords. He was out in Bismarck, North Dakota, playing for a team out there that season, so he wasn't a member of the 35 Crawfords. Still, they had four future Hall of Famers. They were well represented on the East-West All-Star game, and they made their way into the championship by winning the first half. After they won the first half, they actually barnstormed quite a bit in the South and the Midwest and sort of didn't worry so much about winning the second half championship. The Cubans, on the other hand, didn't have a great first half, but they went on to a very, very good second half. They finished the second half with a record of 20-7. One of the things that I think made a difference in their season was when they traded for Rap Dixon mid-season. He really brought some offense to that team and helped them to propel to the playoffs to face the Crawfords. Now, in anticipation of this season, it's important to remember that they played each other quite a bit during this season. And so they played 6 games against each other during the season, the Crawfords winning 5 of those games. The last game that they played against each other was on September 7th in Hinchcliffe Stadium in Paterson, New Jersey. That was the one game that the Cubans had won in a 9-3 victory behind pitcher Frank Blake. One of the things also to remember in the context of this upcoming series was it was secondary in the news, especially in the African-American newspapers, to the upcoming Joe Louis-Max Bear fight, which was to take place on September 24th at Yankee Stadium. That dominated the news. There were always stories about Joe Louis and not as many stories about this upcoming series. So, Game 1 was played at Dyckman Oval in Upper Manhattan. It was played on a Friday night under the lights, September 13th. Frank Blake was the starting pitcher for the Cubans versus Sam Streeter for the Crawfords. Depending on the news, you saw that there were about 7,000 to 8,000 fans in attendance, and the Cubans won 6-2. There's no question about that. There is some question as to how the game actually took place, because the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette had an article with a line score that I have listed here on the bottom, which differed than the story and the line score and box score that was in the New York Age, an African-American newspaper out of New York City. The Pittsburgh paper has Rap Dixon hitting 2 home runs. The New York Age story doesn't say anything about that. What I would trust most is the New York Age story, because someone was probably there, A. B, most importantly, they had a box score that they actually published for this game. And so, despite the conflicting information here, I'm sure the New York Age, relatively sure the New York Age story is more accurate. So the Cubans are up 1-0. Game 2 is played Saturday afternoon, September 14th, at a park at 44th and Parkside in Philadelphia. They played, as you'll see, in Philadelphia quite a few games in this series. Next, Stanley for the Cubans against Roosevelt Davis for the Crawfords. Stanley pitches a complete game shutout. Clyde Spearman for the Cubans hits a home run. It was supposed to be relatively rainy and cold that day, and so there were only about 2,000 people in attendance. And one of the interesting things in the story, again, is the game was delayed by 35 minutes because a few of the umpires didn't know where the game was to be played and showed up late. So, I'm not sure if they went to Shibe Park or where they went, but they ended up here eventually, and the game went on. So now, the Cubans, in winning 4-0, are winning the series 2-0. Game 3 was back in New York City on a Sunday afternoon. Again, the traditional big game days for the Negro Leagues, again at Dyckman Oval. So the ace of the Crawford staff, Leroy Matlock, started against 19-year-old schoolboy Johnny Taylor with the Cubans. It was a relatively competitive game with Matlock really shining. When you see the names here in terms of how the Crawford scored, Josh Gibson tripled in a run in the first inning. Cool Papa Bell tripled in a run in the fifth inning. And Oscar Charleston hit a home run in the sixth inning. If you love the Negro Leagues like I do, those sentences just make you smile. The attendance for this game was about 5,000 to 7,000. This got the Crawfords back into the series, so now it's 2-1 in favor of the Cubans, and it's looking like more of a series. Game 4 is played at Greenlee Field here in Pittsburgh. And so Greenlee Field was owned by Gus Greenlee, the owner of the Crawfords. It was the only field owned and operated by one of the Negro League owners. This featured DeHigo coming to the mound, sort of calling his own number, to face Leroy Matlock, who's pitching on 2 days rest now after having pitched a great game a couple days ago. Matlock doesn't have it as much this day, and DeHigo sure does, and the Cubans go on to win 6-1. DeHigo pitches a complete game. He gives up just 1 run. This is really him at his best, showing all of the different aspects of the game that he's able to put together. So with this, then, the Cubans are up 3-1 on the, I won't give it away, but on the great Crawfords. Game 5 is also played at Greenlee Field here in Pittsburgh. It features Frank Blake starting for the Cubans against Roosevelt Davis for the Crawfords. Both pitchers go the whole way in this game. It's a very, again, competitive game, and in the top of the ninth, the Cubans tie the game on a pinch hit home run by Manuel Garcia, and in the bottom of the ninth, Roosevelt Davis hitting for himself as a pitcher, singles. And then they ran Cool Papa Bell for him, and Bell advanced on a ground out to second base, and then on a sacrifice bunt, scores from second with an error. So it's not one of those, you know, stories that you hear of him scoring from second on a sacrifice bunt. He does score from second on a sacrifice bunt, but there is an error on the play on a wild throw to DeHigo. And so this staves off an elimination for the Crawfords, and now they trail 3-2. Game 6, then, on a Thursday night, moves back to Philadelphia. And this features Nick Stanley against Bert Hunter of the Crawfords. And in my estimation, this is one of the great games in the history of baseball. This is up there with the 86 sixth game of the World Series, with the 75 sixth game of the World Series. This is a great sixth game of the World Series. Both teams, sort of out of the ordinary, use a lot of pitchers. Both teams use three pitchers. As you see, Matlock comes in to finish off the game, pitching last in the lineup for the Crawfords, and DeHigo calls his own number again to come in relief for the Cubans. And in the bottom of the ninth, with the Cubans winning 6-3, and with DeHigo on the mound, who had thrown such a good game a couple days previous, Chester Williams gets on base. Let's Josh Gibson get on base. And then Oscar Charleston comes up and hits one out of the park to tie it up 6-6. And so DeHigo gives up the lead. And then Pat Patterson doubles, and Judy Johnson, who is pinch hitting in that game, knocks him in with a single to get the Crawfords the win, 7-6. And so with two outs in the bottom of the ninth with a three-run lead, the Cubans lose the game, and we'll see what happens the next day. So again, at this location in Philly, at 44th and Parkside, there's a statue remembering the Negro Leagues. There's a very nice mural, a little beat up, and there's a lot of things that the Phillies did invest in this a few years ago. There is no mention whatsoever of the 1935 World Series or that the fact that the Crawfords played there, the Cubans played there. It's mainly about the Philadelphia Stars, but again, this is where one of the great games in perhaps the history of baseball was played. So we will go to Game 7 at a series tied 3-3. This is played on a Friday night, again in Philly. And we have Louis Tiant Sr. Starting for the Cubans against Bill Harvey for the Crawfords. They're both starting their first game in the series. There were 5 lead changes in this game. Back and forth. And then, with the Crawfords winning 5-4 in the eighth inning, Gibson and Josh Gibson, Oscar Charleston hit back-to-back home runs. And then, Sam Bankhead scores on an error by DeHigo. Again, the focus on him, on a ball hit by Cool Papa Bell to allow the Crawfords to go ahead 8-4. The Cubans valiantly strive to come back. Rap Dixon hits a home run in the bottom of the eighth. He had 4 RBI in this game. In the bottom of the ninth, Clyde Spearman hits another home run to try and bring them back, but the rally falls short, and the Crawfords go on to win the game 8-7 and win the series, proclaiming themselves then as league champs. Now, there's a lot of things that you can look at in this series. First of all, there's a lot of strategizing that I don't think we would see today, especially in the use of the pitching. A lot of pinch hitting that seemed to be second thoughts and things like that. Either way, it was an amazing series. So when you look back at this series, Rap Dixon was the offensive star for the Cubans. He put up a slash line of 421, 500, 579. Clyde Spearman hit 3 home runs for the Cubans. Frank Blake pitched very, very well. After the season, it was reported in the news that DeHigo was going to remove himself as manager. However, in 36, he's back as manager of the Cubans. On the Crawford side, Oscar Charleston hit 3 home runs and hit a slash line of 308, 400, 654. Josh Gibson had 11 hits in the 7 games. Didn't walk at all, but he hit 355 and slugged 516. Roosevelt Davis pitched 2 complete games. Leroy Matlock struck out 16 in 17 and a third innings. And when you look at everyone that was involved, including the owners, you had 6 future Hall of Famers involved in this series. Now, in the news the following day, the big news was a doubleheader coming up at Yankee Stadium in which both of these teams were involved. The Nashville Elite Giants were going to play the Cubans. The Philadelphia Stars were going to go up against the Crawfords. And this was the upper part of the newspaper in the African and American newspapers. And the lower part of the newspaper was the story of the 7th game of that championship series, just to show you some of the importance that was put on this. But maybe that's because they were playing at Yankee Stadium, and 15,000 to 25,000 people showed up for that game. It also may have been because there was the promise that Satchel Paige was going to show up and pitch for the Crawfords in that game, but he got a better offer in Chicago and stayed there. In this series, or in this doubleheader, the Crawfords beat the Stars by a score of 12-2, and then the Giants defeated the Cubans by a score of 4-3. Another big game that was played just a couple days later was between the Cubans, or at least some members of the Cubans, and the Babe Ruth All-Stars. And this was played on September 29th at Dyckman Oval, the home of the Cubans. This was Babe Ruth's first appearance back in New York after being released by the Yankees back in February of 35 and after retiring after playing a bit of the season. So he came back, and he put on quite a show in batting practice, hitting an awful lot of home runs, it was reported. And he did play in the game, or at least in the first game. In the first game, he played first base and went 1-for-4 with a double and a walk, and then sat out the second game, which was eventually shortened because of darkness. Again, the Cubans sort of flexed their muscles against these mainly former major leaguers and won the first game by a score of 6-1 and the second game by a score of 14-6. And so, again, this is a sign of the skill of these players. I guess there actually were some current major leaguers also on that Babe Ruth All-Star team. Then there was some barnstorming that these teams undertook, and actually it was something of a combination of the Cubans and the Crawfords joining together under the name of the Crawfords to barnstorm around the country. And so the roster of players that this team had included Josh Gibson, Judy Johnson, Cool Papa Bell, Jimmy Crutchfield, Rap Dixon, Nick Stanley, Ray Dandridge, Webster McDonald, Teddy Page, Vic Harris, and eventually Satchel Paige, who did join the team halfway across the country as they made their way across. And they were playing against a team of major leaguers led by Dizzy Dean. And so they played everywhere from Yankee Stadium, where they drew 20,000 fans, to York, Pennsylvania, where they drew a couple hundred fans, making their way across the country, probably making more money in this barnstorming effort than they did during their regular season, and most especially during that championship series. Now, looking ahead to the 1936 season, the Crawfords were just as good. Satchel rejoined them, and they went on to a record of 42-29-2. The Cubans fell back a little bit and finished with a record of but 21-24. There was actually playoffs that year, which I'm researching right now, but nothing of the prominence of this, and in fact, I can't find any box scores yet of those games. But there were some games that were played, including perhaps a championship doubleheader, plus another game played against the Washington Eli Giants at Sulphur Dell in Nashville. And so when I look back at this 1935 series, I think of, you know, all of the great players that played, all of the great baseball that occurred in New York City and Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, all of the amazing things that went on that, again, are somewhat forgotten. One of the reasons I'm researching this is when I wanted to read about it, there was very little written about this series, very little written accurately, especially about this series. And so I did a lot of this research out of the hopes of trying to bring this to light, and I hope today I'm able to do that and share with you the importance of the series and a lot of the interesting things that I was able to find about it. Thank you very much. And I'm happy to take some questions if anyone has any questions. And what I'll do is I'll try and take your question and then I'll try and repeat it so everyone can hear it.
Come to the mic.
Or you could come to the mic, yes. Okay. If it's on.
Is this on?
It is on. There you go.
I was just interested as to why Cool Papa Bell wasn't in the starting line. Was there an injury? And really the same thing with Judy Johnson in those two games that you showed him coming in.
So Judy Johnson was not a regular starter that year. I believe it was because he was, I think I said, 35 years old. As far as Cool Papa Bell, he was 32, and I don't know. I'm not sure if he was injured throughout part of the season. He did start a majority of the games, at least that I found box scores for. But in that one game, yeah, he was definitely coming off the bench and producing, but definitely coming off the bench there. So I don't have an exact answer for that, but I know for Judy Johnson, he came off the bench quite a bit.
Was there a Midwestern League at that point? Because Chicago was playing in the NL, so the Negro American League was not functioning at that point. The Monarchs were barnstorming those years, or?
I believe there was not a Negro American League at that point. I may be wrong. And the series that they often played were within leagues. Anyway, later there were sort of championship series, almost more like a World Series between two different leagues, although they also did play each other during the season as well. But at this point, I believe this was the only quote-unquote organized Negro League, with the Monarchs and so forth barnstorming instead of playing in league play.
Yes. Yeah, the Cubans Park in New York again. I told you beforehand, I've never heard of it. Where was it? I don't know your city. Where was it?
So here's my... When I drive my son to college, who goes to college in Westchester, I go past an exit off of the Riverside Parkway, I believe, where there's an exit for Dyckman Street. And so I'm assuming Dyckman Oval must have been there somewhere. It's in northern Manhattan, above Yankee Stadium. Yankee Stadium's in the Bronx, but in the northmost part of Manhattan.
But near Riverside Drive?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know where it was torn down?
I do not. I know, or I believe, the Cubans played there for a lot of their existence, but no, I'm not sure when it was torn down.
Washington Heights.
Okay. Washington Heights, part of Manhattan, upper Manhattan. Okay.
Where was your Greenleaf Field in Pittsburgh?
Greenlee Field was in the Hill District of Pittsburgh. There is a marker there now. When the Molloy Conference met here 5 years ago, help me, Ted, maybe it was even longer ago, there was the placement of that marker there. There's been some interesting research on that field by Jerry Strecker, who published some work on that, and on the creation of that field. The picture, the iconic picture of the Crawfords here, this is outside of Greenlee Field, so you see, you know, the structure that they had here, the brick structure, and when they had it for baseball primarily, but they also did things like motorcycle racing there and a lot of other sports throughout the year that they played in Greenlee Field, but in the Hill District section of Pittsburgh.
Did any players from the 1935 that series talk about it after the fact, like years later, about Game 6 being as incredible as certainly some of the great World Series games?
You know, that's a great question, and I've not come across anything. Now, again, a lot of the bios, like the Josh Gibson bio, even the Alex Pompez bio, mention the series, some with a little bit of detail, but not, there's no box score detail. There's nothing like that at all. Most of those are really looking back at the longer stretch of the history of these things. I've not come across a single quote, now that you say that. Not that there's not any out there, but no. Good question.
Did the Philadelphia Tribune cover any of the games that were played in Philadelphia?
I don't know. I have sort of used various sources to be able to get the different newspaper clippings that I have. Google News used to have a lot. Newspapers.com has some. That's where I've gotten the Courier information. The Philadelphia Tribune, I am not sure if it's either a part of either of those sources. I do believe I have Philadelphia Inquirer pieces here, but I'm not sure of that. Yeah.
Is the feeling in Manhattan still around? I actually live in Manhattan there. I've been to Dyckman Avenue before, and I wonder how it close it is.
Which field?
There's this field called Pleasantness Field. It's by the train station, Dyckman Avenue on K1.
I'm
not sure.
I don't know. Others may know for sure. I don't know.
Dyckman Field was closer to the Harlem River.
Okay.
Below where the Columbia University paper pole.
Okay.
Or whatever that's called.
Okay. It was demolished in 1938.
1938, so only 3 years later. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you all very much.